headlines. The U.S. president called his Russian counterpart a killer, saying that Moscow will pay a price over meddling in U.S. elections, a charge Russia denies. U.S. officials say the 6 women of Asian descent are among those killed in a string of shootings in the state of Georgia amid growing violence against minorities. And health officials in the occupied West Bank say that the number of Palestinians needing hospitalization due to the coronavirus has reached a breaking point. Well, welcome to the studios near the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. President Joe Biden has issued a stark warning to his Russian counterpart, saying that Vladimir Putin will pay a price for what he called interfering in the 2020 American presidential election. Biden revealed that he had warned about a potential U.S. response during his January phone call with Putin. Biden vowed that the consequences would come soon. He also said that he thinks his Russian counterpart has no soul and is a killer. Comments followed a U.S. intelligence report that Putin had directed efforts to swing the 2020 presidential election in favor of Donald Trump. Russia has rejected the allegations as baseless and an attempt by Washington to create a negative image of Moscow. It says the report is a pretext to impose new sanctions on Russia. Tim Kirby is a radio host and political analyst who joins us. Well, first of all, let's go with the way that Biden has actually described Putin. Why would he call him a killer? It doesn't seem like it's connected to the accusations that the U.S. has leveled against Russia and Putin in particular.
Well, one thing that we have to take note of is during that interview, Biden was speaking very incoherently. As someone who speaks English as a native language, it's very strange, I'll put it that way. And secondly, the reporter was the one who sort of threw out this idea, the question about whether Putin is a killer or not. So it was a bit more on the reporter, and Biden just sort of confirmed it, which will allow him to maybe deny it later if he wants to. But the key thing is when you're able to say basically whatever you want without any form of punishment, people tend to go to extremes. And I think this is a good example of that.
Okay, so it's no secret the way that Russia is approaching, I'm sorry, the way that U.S. is approaching Russia. It has cited Russia as being a national security risk. But this escalation with Russia at the same time that's almost concurrently going on with China, doesn't that worry the U.S. how these two, if they haven't already, obviously draw each other closer, which is not something I'm guessing that the U.S. would like?
Well, apparently Biden and his camp don't, because the Democrats have sort of let me put it this way. There's a new expression that if you're a Republican, you hate China. If you're a Democrat, you hate Russia. And that sort of logic seems to hold very true, and Biden is definitely not an exception to that rule. And he has been very strongly anti-Russian, and especially all of the actions of him and his son in the Ukraine have definitely put the icing on that cake of hatred. So that's basically the way it is. One could argue that it would be in the interest of the United States to have better relations with Russia, but there are people who don't feel that way. If the objective is for the United States to be the sole world hyperpower, then the rise of Russia is absolutely unacceptable to them, and that is probably why for the last 10 or so years the West has really been trying to continuously push Russia down with any half-hearted excuse that they can dream up.
And what can we expect from Russia if, or should I say, when the sanctions get applied and the way that Biden has described Putin?
Unfortunately, we should expect nothing. Russia is very bad at dealing with Washington. They're very bad with dealing with these sort of more emotional... essentially, what Biden did was an attempt to dominate Russia. One thing that oftentimes con artists or sort of middle managers do to try to trick people into getting what they want from them is to use these sort of very aggressive statements of dominance, and that's maybe what this was. Unfortunately, Russia is very bad at understanding this and reacting to it. The reaction from Russia is probably just going to be some sort of official request for an apology or some other trivial nothing that doesn't matter. But ultimately, the process of continuing sanctions has gone unabated, like I said, since the Ukrainian Revolution in 2014, so there's really no particular sign that any of this would stop anyways. It didn't stop under Trump, who was supposedly some sort of Russian agent, so it really doesn't matter.
Thank you for that, Tim Kirby, radio host and political analyst. Many thanks. Moving on, China has slammed the U.S. for imposing sanctions on 24 senior Chinese officials, urging Washington to end its interference in the country's internal affairs.
Attempts ahead of the dialogue to control the tempo and put pressure on China will not succeed. China resolutely opposes and condemns this and has already carried out necessary countermeasures.
Foreign Ministry spokesman also said the U.S. move fully reveals its sinister intentions. The U.S. measure came ahead of a cliffhanger meeting between American and Chinese officials in Alaska, which will be the first diplomatic overture since President Joe Biden entered the White House. Meanwhile, the Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced that Washington plans to take an uncompromising stance in the talks. The top two economies remain at odds over a host of issues, including trade, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the South China Sea. Six women of Asian descent have been killed in a string of shooting incidents in the U.S. state of Georgia, raising concerns about growing violence against minorities. The women were among the eight victims of three attacks around the city of Atlanta. South Korea has confirmed that four of the victims were of Korean descent. Police have detained a white man, Robert Aaron, on the suspicion of staging all the attacks. According to Georgia state officials, the bloodshed matched a, quote, pattern of violence against Asian Americans during the coronavirus pandemic. Advocacy groups say attacks against minority groups have spiked markedly after the COVID-19 outbreak in the U.S., with women and the elderly being the prime targets. The U.S. says it's facing the biggest increase of migrants at its southwestern borders in 20 years. The Secretary of the Homeland Security says the number of attempted border crossings from Central America and Mexico has steadily increased since April of last year. Alejandro Mayorkas says the most single adults and families are being turned away. Republican critics have blamed the policies of the new administration for the current crisis. Amid rising criticism, President Joe Biden has urged migrants not to come to the U.S. Poverty, violence, and corruption in Mexico and some Central American countries have made people set journeys to the U.S. in hopes of a better life. The Palestinian health minister says the coronavirus situation in the occupied West Bank has reached a breaking point, as hospitals already under intense pressure are flooded with patients. May Al-Kayla described the situation as alarming and dangerous. In the West Bank, more than 156,000 coronavirus cases and nearly 1,600 deaths have been reported so far. The Palestinian Authority has already said that a new wave of patients is exceeding its ability to cope. The PA took the delivery of 60,000 Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines via the UN's COVAX program. This is a stark contrast to Israel, where normality is gradually returning. This is the regime is pushing ahead with one of the world's most intense vaccination campaigns for its own population, except some Palestinians who have Israeli work permits. Israel has been criticized by human rights groups for ignoring the suffering of the people under occupation. Well, joining us from occupied Ramallah, Mona Kandil joins us to explain to us more about what is going on there. Mona, it seems like the situation is getting dire, if it's not already, for the hospitals in particular, and of course the spread of the COVID-19 amongst Palestinians. Tell us if it has reached that breaking point and what is being planned to deal with it.
Well, unfortunately, it's 1 year on, and the COVID-19 is still rages on in the occupied West Bank, with hospitals, as you have mentioned, filled up amid a shortage of medical equipment. Several weeks ago, the Palestinian Authority had to adopt new measures, strict measures, across the occupied West Bank. And 2 weeks ago, there is a complete and strict lockdown to cope with the new wave of the pandemic. However, the numbers continue to increase. More deaths are being registered, more casualties among the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, as well as in the West Bank and Jerusalem, and in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinians are demanding that they should receive, the Palestinian Authority should get the vaccines for them. Today, however, the Palestinian Authority received the first batch of COVID-19 vaccines from the global COVAX sharing initiative. The Palestinian Ministry of Health said 38 doses of the Pfizer vaccine would be used as of Sunday. However, 24,000 of the AstraZeneca vaccine would be stored until there is a scientific decision. But at the same time, Israel, while giving their residents the vaccine, the first dose and the second dose, however, they are, in a way or another, are able to control this pandemic, but are not allowing the Palestinians living in the West Bank to get the vaccine. This could be today, according to Human Rights Watch, the Palestinian Authority is facing maybe the third wave of the COVID-19, and there is still danger here in the occupied West Bank.
Is there any backlash that's going to transform into anything, whether coming from the Palestinians or from the PA, in order to get the attention that's needed for a very dire situation? And it's really perplexing how Israel is allowing its own population to obviously get the vaccination needed without the Palestinians needing it, because this is a pandemic. It's, you know, it's viruses spread. So I'm not too sure the logic that the Israeli regime is using.
Well, several days ago, the Palestinian Authority demanded its residents in the occupied West Bank to register online those who who want to get the vaccines, but it wasn't clear when the Palestinian Authority would be receiving it. But the Palestinian Authority revealed that it hoped to cover about only 20% of the West Bank of the Palestinian population through the COVAX initiative, not more than that. It will have to wait to get more vaccines from World States or the COVAX program. But other than that, of course, the Israelis maybe will not giving the Palestinians as a gift this vaccine. However, a human rights organization said it's Israel's responsibility to ensure that Palestinian population in the occupied West Bank receive the vaccines, because it's the occupiers of the Palestinian territories.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. Mona Kandil there from Occupied Ramallah. Many thanks. Six European Union members have demanded more coronavirus vaccines from the bloc amid ongoing rifts over the distribution of the jabs. An EU official says Austria, Bulgaria, Croatia, the Czech Republic, Latvia, and Slovenia have raised concerns over what they call possible gaps in the vaccine distribution among member states. They complain that vaccines are not being delivered proportionately. The EU faces an acute squeeze of COVID-19 jabs due to reduced deliveries by the pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca. Many countries in Europe have also suspended the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine over reports of blood clot incidents in connection with the shot.
Fresh chaos in the European Union's sluggish coronavirus vaccination drive, beset by delays and supply shortfalls in recent months. Questions about the safety of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine after reports of suspected deaths due to blood clots forming after inoculation.
We have decided to make a temporary and precautionary suspension for the next few weeks so that the European Medical Agency can evaluate in detail these cases and so that the national pharmaceutical agencies can offer an answer to these signals.
A move adopted by dozens of other EU nations, hailed by some as the right thing to do and criticized by others for fueling vaccine hesitancy among people already wary of coronavirus jabs. But on Monday, reassuring words from the World Health Organization.
This does not necessarily mean these events are linked to vaccination, but it's routine practice to investigate them. And it shows that the surveillance system works and that effective controls are in place.
The EU's own medicines regulator, AMA, has also made it clear the reported side effects and deaths needed to be investigated carefully. Scientists at Oxford University and AstraZeneca say of the more than 17 million people who have received the vaccine in the UK and the EU, fewer than 40 cases of blood clots have been reported as of last week. This is not the first time the Oxford AstraZeneca jab is running into trouble. The recent EU move comes against a backdrop of concerns raised about how the vaccine data have been released. And some European leaders, including French President Emmanuel Macron, have questioned its effectiveness. The British Prime Minister has defended his government's flagship coronavirus jab. But experts say a discontinuation of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine would deal a serious blow to the UK's prestige. Both the World Health Organization and the European Medicines Agency insist the benefits of the jabs outweigh their risks. All eyes now on the outcome of reviews of available data by WHO and EMA experts this week to decide whether the vaccine has indeed caused blood clots in those inoculated or have those events only been a coincidence. Saeed Puriza, London.
People are casting ballots on the last day of general elections in the Netherlands. Voters are heading to bike through polling stations and museums to cast ballots on the third day of voting. The elderly and people at risk voted on previous days. The Dutch election is seen as a COVID-dominated one, with Prime Minister Mark Rutte seeking to return to power. He's continued on a caretaker role since January over a scandal in which thousands of parents were falsely accused of scamming childcare. Opinion polls show the liberal VVD party is on course to lead a fourth successive coalition. Russia says that Britain's plans to expand its nuclear weapons stockpile have dealt a serious blow to the concept of arms control. The Russian Foreign Ministry says it will take the British move into account when working on its own military planning. On Tuesday, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that his government will increase its nuclear warhead stockpile by more than 40%. He said the UK aims to ensure its security in a more risky global environment. British campaigners have slammed the plan also. They say that it amounts to a violation of international law. Labour Party leader Keir Starmer also accused the Tory government of having a worldwide reputation for breaking international law. Political analyst Marcus Papadopoulos says that Britain's decision to increase its nuclear stockpile undermines the non-proliferation treaty.
Britain's decision actually serves to make the world a more unstable place. And Russia's allegation is absolutely correct. Britain is a signatory to the non-proliferation treaty, but nonetheless, Britain's decision to increase its nuclear stockpile serves only to undermine the non-proliferation treaty. And countries around the world which may be interested in developing nuclear weapons will simply look at the British government's decision as one which has no serious intention to upholding the non-proliferation treaty.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United States has been criticized for purchasing 200 million more COVID-19 vaccines for its own citizens and pushing poorer countries and vulnerable populations to the back of the queue, while experts estimate that the low-income countries will experience wide access after 2022. We present you an article written by Azad Issa. The piece is titled, Experts Warn of Protracted Pandemic Amid Vaccine Apartheid. The article has been taken from the MiddleEastEye.net website. Please stay with us for more of Azad Issa's article. Global inequality campaigners and health experts have warned of protracted public health crises in several North African and West Asian countries amid the monopoly of COVID-19 vaccine by wealthy nations, noting that rich nations were racing ahead of poorer ones to immunize their citizens. Amjad El-Khouli, an epidemiologist at the World Health Organization WHO's regional office for the Eastern Mediterranean region, said, "We're seeing an unequal distribution of COVID-19 vaccine around the world." Citing World Health Organization data, Middle East Eyes said only 14 out of 21 countries in the Eastern Mediterranean region, which extends from Morocco to Afghanistan, have received inoculations, equivalent to little more than 1% of the population of the entire region. Amjad El-Khouli said, "This has never been more critical than in our region, where health workers are a rare and valuable resource, and vulnerable people should be the first to receive support rather than be left behind." His remarks came just days after World Health Organization expert Mark Ryan said 80% of all global vaccines had been administered in just 10 wealthy countries. The starkest illustrations of vaccine inequality were evident in West Asia, where countries such as Qatar, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates were inoculating nationals and foreign workers at a frenetic pace, while countries like Yemen were lagging behind. The report also referred to the situation in the occupied Palestine, where about 60% of Israelis have received jabs, whilst Palestinians living under occupation have been told they could have to wait for many months before they're vaccinated. Activists say it is systematic dereliction of political leadership at the highest level that is triggering this threat to global public health. Anna Marriott, health policy advisor for the charity Oxfam, says, "It is vaccine apartheid." She adds, "There is no other way of describing it." Anna Marriott says, "If you think of the promises that were made at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, that the vaccine would be a global public good, our leaders have failed." In an attempt to seek a more equitable access to the COVID-19 vaccine, the World Health Organization, WHO, and the Gavi Vaccine Alliance are leading a facility called COVAX to deliver doses of approved vaccines fairly around the world. However, global campaigners say donations alone are not going to cut it. The United States has been criticized for purchasing 200 million more vaccines for its own citizens and pushing poorer countries and vulnerable populations to the back of the queue. While experts estimate the low-income countries will experience wide access to the vaccine only after 2022. El-Khouli says, "We understand that every government and leadership worldwide are keen on vaccinating their own populations. However, we reiterate that wider is wiser, meaning that introducing the vaccine to the priority categories in all countries is much better than vaccinating all people in a few countries." Experts warn that delaying inoculations will allow the virus opportunity to mutate, potentially undermining available vaccines and ultimately global recovery. El-Khouli says, "The global economy cannot recover if there are disparities in global vaccine coverage. Not only will vaccines help save lives and stabilize health systems, but they can help to drive a global economic recovery. That recovery cannot take place if half of the world is hamstrung from the economic fallout of COVID-19." U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said that Washington should be instead ensuring the broadest possible distribution of the coronavirus vaccine. Ilhan Omar says letting people in the Global South wait years for the vaccine is a policy choice, and they don't have to make it. Until everyone is safe from the virus, no one is. The United States has also been slammed for undermining the attempt to accelerate the vaccine rollout elsewhere. According to the report, the United States and other Western countries are opposing calls from temporarily waiving the World Trade Organization's trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights for those technologies needed to address the coronavirus pandemic. The proposal was put forward by South Africa and India and endorsed by 100 other countries. Anna Maria from the charity Oxfam says there are solutions on the table which rich countries are standing in the way of. They need to support the TRIPS intellectual property waiver from developing countries, and unlocking the supply of the vaccine is the only route to redressing this apartheid situation. The hoarding of medical supplies is neither novel nor unique to the coronavirus vaccine. In 2009, the World Health Organization had a grapple with the greed of wealthy nations buying up the H1N1 vaccine that inevitably tied up global supply and left the rest of the world without access to the vaccine. Prior to the H1N1, there was the HIV/AIDS pandemic. Fatima Hassan, a social justice activist and human rights lawyer, says today's situation is eerily similar to the HIV/AIDS epidemic and crisis of access in the late 1990s and early 2000s, when the diagnostic and therapeutic tools to save millions of lives were there, but the will to share them was not. Fatima Hassan says, without the temporary TRIPS waiver now, countries will be required to take individual domestic action and legal measures whilst managing a pandemic. Sharifa Sakalala, an associate professor at the School of Law at the University of Warwick in England, says the problem goes far beyond the question of intellectual property rights. Sharifa Sakalala says human rights have largely been ignored in arguments about vaccine rollouts and substituted for arguments of equity. This feels like a missed opportunity to really think about the vaccine as something that is fundamental to the right of life, to the right to health, but also access to wider social and economic rights, given that ordinary life has been so constrained by this coronavirus pandemic. The pandemic has taken its heavy toll in Yemen as well. Yemen is currently grappling with a Saudi military aggression. Nahla Arishi, a Yemeni pediatrician, says COVID-19 shook countries with advanced healthcare systems and services. What will it do to a country like Yemen that has lived in the shadow of war for the past 5 years? According to the Middle East Eye, no more than half of Yemen's medical facilities are currently functioning. Middle East Eye also cited reports issued last year as saying that there were fewer than 10 medics for every 10,000 Yemenis. Anna Marriott from the charity Oxfam says, "We know that over 53% of the population in Yemen is in need of humanitarian assistance. 16.2 million Yemenis rely on food aid to survive. So the crisis was already immense and completely unacceptable even before the COVID-19 pandemic." She adds, "Unless we get vaccines to people, that suffering is going to escalate every day." Recently, United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres blasted what he called many examples of vaccine nationalism and hoarding of vaccines during the pandemic. Antonio Guterres said in a statement that wealthier countries are far outpacing poorer nations in vaccinating their populations, and called on coronavirus vaccines to be seen as a global public good. The United Nations chief, Guterres, said The global vaccination campaign represents the greatest moral test of our times. And he criticized side deals with COVID-19 vaccine manufacturers that undermine access to all people in the world. Antonio Guterres said, ensuring that all the peoples of the world are vaccinated and many low-income countries have not yet received a single dose of the vaccine is essential to restart the global economy and help the world move from locking down societies to locking down the virus. He added, the world needs to unite to produce and distribute sufficient vaccines for all, which means at least doubling manufacturing capacity of the vaccine around the world. Antonio Guterres added, that effort must start now. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, some 117 million people are confirmed to have been infected by the coronavirus, and more than 2.6 million people have already lost their lives.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Quraysh. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam urged the Muslims to feel pity for the orphan and to have affection for the weak. He, peace be upon him, said, whoever has four qualities, Allah will build a house for him in the garden. The one who shelters the orphan, has mercy on the weak, feels compassion for his parents, and treats his servant gently.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find that there are very many beautiful and interesting conversations and dialogues in the historical texts of the Muslims. We find that there is one very interesting and profound conversation between Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and his son Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, in this conversation between father and son, Imam al-Baqir supplied his son with a group of very valuable commandments, truly which are full of wisdom, knowledge, and faith. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says some of the following things from a whole host of different things which he said to his son. Imam al-Baqir says, "O my little son, indeed Allah has hidden three things in three things. He has hidden His divine pleasure in His divine obedience. So do not scorn anything of obedience. Perhaps Allah's pleasure is in it." Then Imam al-Baqir says, "Allah has hidden His divine wrath in His divine disobedience. So do not scorn anything of disobedience. Perhaps Allah's wrath is in it." And finally, Imam al-Baqir says, "Allah has hidden His friends among His creatures. So do not scorn anyone, for perhaps He is a friend." Three very beautiful pieces of advice from Imam al-Baqir to his son Imam Sadiq, peace and blessings upon them both. One, try your best to do every act of obedience. Two, try your best to refrain from every act of disobedience. And three, respect people, for they are the creatures of Allah, and perhaps they are a friend of Allah as well. Beautiful pieces of advice in this dialogue between Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
One of the distinction of this, you know, line of imams compared to the other schools of thought is the direct and straight channel to Rasulullah and his seerah. It was the fifth imam the first time, and of course his son also repeated the same words, that whenever I narrate something and I don't give you a sanad, I do not give you the chain of narration, you can assume that what I'm saying has come from my father, and what he said comes from his father Hussein bin Ali. What he said comes from Amir al-Mu'mineen, and from Ali it comes from Rasulullah, and whatever Rasulullah says comes from Jibreel, and whatever Jibreel conveys to the Rasul is by the command of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the fifth and the sixth imam, you know, you will see, they will just say Qala Rasulullah. They will not go through the process of sanad. Except in one case, in the life of the fifth Imam, and that's very interesting, and there is a real reason behind it. Our fifth Imam actually narrates the Hadith of Saqalain through a channel which is not of the Ahlul Bayt, a channel of the Sahabi of the Prophet who lived longest. He says that I have been told by Jabir bin Abdullah al-Ansari, who says that Rasulullah said, "Inni tarikum fikum al-saqalain, kitab Allah wa itrati ahlu bayti." Some of the ulama actually mentioned that this is an exceptional sanad in the statements of the fifth Imam. He never, goes through Sahaba. But there was a reason. This is a hadith of Saqalain. This is one of the main, bases of the vilayat of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And there is an accusation from the other side. They say, well, their statements of our fifth and sixth Imam, they call it Mursal. Mursal means narration of the Prophet which doesn't have sanad between the narrator and the Prophet because they didn't see them. So this is Mursal that doesn't have any value. But since this was a controversial issue between the Mabahib, Imam wanted to do Itmam Hujjat. That now I'm not talking about our internal, silsila that we have in the family. Now I'm going through your silsila here, and the Sahabi who lived the longest, who brought the salam of Rasulullah, my grandfather, to me, he was there, and he himself, heard Rasulullah saying, "Inni tarikum fikum saqalain, kitab Allah wa itrati ahlu bayt."
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Evidence suggests that committed foreign aid is being redirected from peace-building programs into efforts to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic, and is likely to have ever more of an impact on the ground than a decrease in foreign aid. A further reduction in funding and troops for United Nations peacekeeping missions is also likely. We have prepared for you an article written by Eleanor Gordon. Eleanor Gordon is a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. The piece is titled "Peacebuilding Suffers During Pandemic Obsession." The article has been taken from the Conversation website. Please stay with us for more of Eleanor Gordon's article. Resources critical to peace building and to countries vulnerable to conflict have been significantly reduced as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. In conflict zones from Ukraine to Syria, hundreds of thousands of people are suffering in silence. These conflicts risk becoming forgotten crises and are intensifying as states and non-state armed militant groups utilize the pandemic and a distracted international community for their own strategic advantage. The figures are alarming. For instance, according to the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, foreign direct investment collapsed in 2020, falling by as much as 42% to an estimated $859 billion, compared with $1.5 trillion in previous year 2019. Many humanitarian organizations have also recorded a dramatic drop in donations from private individuals and fundraising activities, or expect private donations will decline as the global recession hits. Profound cuts to foreign aid are anticipated as countries continue to invest heavily in COVID-19-related activities whilst facing severe economic recession. Already several governments, including the British government, have announced major cuts to aid budgets in light of COVID-19. A decline in public support for foreign aid, typical in times of financial crisis, is also likely to encourage cuts. This in turn is likely to have a negative effect on peace building, which is already underfunded. Evidence suggests that committed foreign aid being redirected from peace-building programs into efforts to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic is likely to have been more of an impact on the ground than a decrease in foreign aid. For instance, Britain, France, and Australia have announced a reorientation of their aid commitment to medical infrastructure. A further reduction in funding and troops for United Nations peacekeeping missions is also likely. This is in turn predicted to reduce the capacity of peace operations by about 30-50% over the next year or two. A global survey of organizations engaged in peace building was conducted to assess the impact of these cuts on the ground. In the survey, 62% of participants said they or their organization had experienced a reduction in funding for peace building work. In addition, 75% of those who took part in the survey said COVID-19 had or was likely to have had a negative impact on the financial security of their organization. Other global surveys have had similar results. Reduced funds will also inevitably affect employment and job security for these organizations. The survey found 74% of those who took part felt their work was more precarious, whilst 56% knew of someone in the sector who had lost a job as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. On top of this, 75% said the focus of their work had changed. They referred to strong signals given by donors to pivot activities towards COVID-19-related issues, even if other needs were perceived to be more urgent. The reduction in resources comes when they are most needed. This is because COVID-19 and its effects, economic shocks, unemployment, extreme poverty, and vaccine inequalities worsen conflict situations. These negative impacts are likely to intensify as the coronavirus pandemic persists. After a short decline after the pandemic was declared in March of 2020, conflicts in several countries increased again. This notably often takes the form of violence against civilians by state forces and militias. Escalating insecurity has already been witnessed in several conflict zones, including in Syria, Colombia, Somalia, Yemen, Nigeria, Burkina Faso, Afghanistan, the Philippines, and Myanmar. As states and non-state actors and various militant groups exploit the pandemic to their own strategic advantage. many of the ceasefires declared in response to the United Nations Secretary General's call for a global ceasefire in March of 2020 have fallen apart. COVID-19 has exposed weaknesses in global governance, especially in terms of preparedness and threat mitigation. To address these weaknesses, countries need to invest in preparedness, to be aware of the complex interconnectedness of security threats, and avoid knee-jerk reactions to singular risks that divert attention and resources away from longer-term threats. There is also a need to communicate more effectively to the public about how aid budgets are being spent. This includes stressing how aid programs benefit donors as well as recipient countries, given public opinion can be a key factor in determining whether aid budgets are reduced. The increased risk of armed conflict as a result of the diversion of resources and attention towards the COVID-19 pandemic has global repercussions. So too does the difficulty in controlling COVID-19 within conflict zones and beyond their often porous borders until a widely accessible vaccine becomes available to the most disadvantaged people in the world.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters 7300 kHz for the Indian subcontinent and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more. No more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. First and foremost, my most profound and, you know, gladness of congratulations to the Imam of the time, Imam al-Sahib al-Asr wal-Zaman, and to the Shia, and to all Muslims throughout the world. For this individual is loved by all Muslims, regardless of what denomination you follow. Forget Muslims, this individual is loved by humanity. If this person or a person, he or she, has an iota of humanity in their hearts, they love this individual. Today is the birth, or the day that is reported to be the birth of the second grandson of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. You know, that individual whose name and whose actions have changed so many people. That individual whose act on the day of Ashura changed humanity in ways that me and you can never imagine, and was the precursor to many things to come in history. Again, this is not our discussion, but it is on this day that we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He grants us the opportunity to, inshallah, in the very near future, be it in, or be it rather on the day of Ashura, or on the day of Arba'een, or on this day, or in the nights of Qadr, or on the 15th of Sha'ban, all of these big nights, on the day or the night of Eid, when the ziyarah of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, on the day of Arafah also, that it is mentioned that, you know, the angels go to Arafah after they go to the haram of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So this, we ask Allah to grant us the opportunity to do the ziyarah of this individual, inshallah, on one of these days, or any day in the very near future, inshallah, by the right of this Imam, as a gift to us because of this blessed Imam alayhi salam. My gift to you, my dear brothers and sisters, on this day is a very beautiful tradition from the Imam himself. The Imam says regarding the Holy Quran and the knowledge of the Holy Quran, he says that we are those in which the knowledge of the book is with us, and we are those who expound that which is in the Holy Book. Nobody has what we have in terms of the knowledge, in terms of the explanation, in terms of the understanding of the Holy Quran. Nobody has what we have, the Imam says. And the Imam explains why. لِأَنَّنَا, for surely we, that is the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, أَهْلُ سِرِّ اللَّهِ, we are the people who hold the secrets of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The debate.